Good morning. At this time, the Committee on Justice Appropriations will come to order. Deborah, if you'll please call the roll.
Chair Mike Birney.
Here.
Vice Chair Cummings.
Here.
Ranking Member Roussan.
Here.
Representative Diaz.
Here.
Kerner.
Here.
LaRosa.
Here.
Mayfield.
Here.
Metz.
Here.
Moskowitz. Pilon.
Here.
Swartz. Schlossberg.
Here.
Van Zandt.
Here.
Quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Deborah. At this time, would remind those here today and those in the audience to please turn off your cell phones or put them on silent. Members, welcome. Welcome back. We've got a new year with new challenges along with new opportunities. Look forward to working with you all again this year, just like last year. My goal is to be accessible to each and every one of you. If you have any questions as we continue through the process or you just wish to discuss, come by my office. Come by and see me. And I look forward to another very successful year. At this time, I'd also like to introduce the new guy on the block, our new vice chair, Representative Cummings. Representative Cummings, you are recognized to say whatever you would like to.
That's dangerous. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's yeah.
And that'll be the last time.
That's it. No, thank you. It's an honor, and I look forward to serving under your leadership. Heard great things about Loretta and her staff, although I know we're going to be not have the opportunity to work with her long, but you know, we're meeting tomorrow, and I look forward to learning as much from her as I can, and as well as working with this committee. I see there's a couple members to my right, Representative LaRosa and Diaz, that I'm sorry you've had to deal with. Maybe I can help you provide some authority over those young men. But thank you again, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Now, we all know, sadly, that Loretta Darity will be leaving us. As well to a well-deserved retirement, but I am pleased and excited to announce our new budget chief, Tony Lloyd, as Loretta's replacement. Tony is a former House Appropriations employee and is currently at the Department of Economic Opportunity. Tony will be the budget chief for Justice Appropriations, and he'll start next Tuesday, October 1st, and we'll introduce him formally to the committee at the October meeting. But for now, Tony, we welcome you back to the House. Thank you. Members, today we will have staff presentations on the long-range financial outlook, an update on health services from the Department of Corrections, and a presentation on the Criminal Justice Estimating Conference. We will postpone the presentation on bed capacity from the Department of Corrections to a later date. Members, one of the drivers for the Department of Juvenile Justice is the shared detention cost. This relates as to how the counties were previously billed for youth and county detention facilities. I've asked Loretta to briefly describe the issue for the purposes of this presentation. However, I'd ask that you reserve any detailed questions at this time. In one of the upcoming committee meetings, the department will give a detailed presentation, and we can ask specific questions at that time. So for the presentation of the long-range financial outlook, major drivers, Loretta, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Constitution requires that the Legislative Budget Commission issue the long-range financial outlook in order to assist the legislature in making decisions that include the major workload and revenue estimate. This was approved at the September LBC meeting. The outlook provide estimates for 3 years. However, for the purpose of the presentation today, we will concentrate on next year, fiscal year 14-15. The major drivers are separated by tiers, tier one being the critical needs are issues that we must fund, and of course in our area we only have the one, and that's the criminal justice estimating conference due to the increase in our prison population. And the second is the Tier 2 or other high priorities. And these are issues where we have historically funded in the past or some other circumstances that have arisen since session that we need to address. The first one, the increase in the criminal justice estimating conference of the prison system population. The CJIC, as we know it, and Kathy McCarron is here, and we'll go over that in detail about some of the trends of why the increase in the population. But CJIC has increased, the projected increase that the prison population would increase by an estimate 4,000 inmates over the next 5 years. Although we do not have to fund for the construction of those of facilities, we do have to fund for the operational costs. That includes health services, education, just the housing, meals, substance abuse program, and those type services. So for next fiscal year, the outlook includes $46.8 million to fund DOC for the increase in the prison population. That is the only issue that we have in Tier 1. The other issues are in Tier 2, and again, these are some have historically been funded and some are issues that have arisen since session that we must address. The first one is in Department of Juvenile Justice is the Behavioral Health Overlay Services, referred to as the BHOS. It provides services for medically, mental health, and substance abuse treatment to children who are placed in group shelters or residential group settings in low and moderate risk DJJ commitment programs. And these are overlay services, which basically mean it overlays the services that are provided, such as the room and the board, and just a day-to-day routine delinquency programming. Recently, DJJ was notified by ACA, the Agency for Healthcare Administration, through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services that DJJ non-secure residential providers could no longer bill Medicaid for behavioral overlay services beginning in fiscal year 13-14. However, in the past, historically, part of those services were funded with federal funds. So with this change in the federal policy, the department will now have to pick up the portion that the federal government had been paying for these services. The long-range financial outlook includes $12.1 million of recurring and $10.6 of non-recurring. ACA had been picking up a piece of it, the match, and they will continually, at least for 14, 15 in the out years, pay for the match, and GR would be given for the portion that was previously covered by the feds. The next issue in DJJ is the prevention and intervention services. Historically, we have funded this in the past. It's for services such as your redirection or upfront services that would defer or you from going into a residential program. And the outlook provides $3.4 million for shared for the prevention and intervention program services. The next issue that we have, and again, as the chair had mentioned on the shared detention costs, the department will at a later date come in and explain this in more detail, the history of it, where we are now, and where the department will proceed with this issue. But for now, just a quick brief history of it. In 2004, legislation passed that required joint financial participation of state and counties to pay for juveniles that were in county detention centers. The county was responsible for the predisposition, and the state was responsible for the post-disposition of kids that were in detention. in 2009, some counties challenged that DJJ's methodology of how they calculated the cost of what their portion was and the portion that the state was paying. And basically, it challenged how DJJ defined final court disposition. In June 2000, fast forwarding quickly here, but in June 2013, the first DCA ruled in favor of the counties that the department may only bill the counties for youth whose cases had not had a disposition, either a commitment or probation. So basically, most of the costs, in most cases, if a youth was on probation and subsequently or later was placed back into detention, the cost of that youth being placed back into detention was the responsibility of the state, not of the county, and that's how DJJ had previously billed the counties. If the youth came back, then it was the county's responsibility. But again, the first DCA ruled in favor. So having said that, it resulted in the department having a deficit because they no longer have, they do not have the GR to fund those detention costs, as the ruling said. So the outlook funds $39.3 million for fiscal year 14-15 to pick up the costs to pay for youth in detention previously that was billed for the counties. The next issues are the fixed capital outlay issues are in correction facilities, and this done, we just look at critical, the department provide a list of critical needs of critical facilities that need repair, and the outlook funds $6.8 million for DOC. In the Department of Juvenile Justice, again, we look at the critical list of facilities that that are provided by the department. The long-range financial outlook provide $2.8 million for DJJ and for the Supreme Court and the District Courts of Appeal. The outlook provide $2 million of non-recurring dollars for fixed capital outlay for major repairs. And, Mr. Chair, that concludes the major drivers as approved by the Legislative Budget Commission on the financial long-range financial outlook.
Thank you, Loretta. Are there any questions from the members? Representative Schwartz, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, and thanks for the presentation. I was just curious if it's too long or we should you just brief me another time why the federal government decided not to fund the portion of the behavioral health. I mean, or are they just not funding the overlay, the day-to-day operations? Just curious what happened.
Loretta, you're recognized.
In the past, the Fed had been funding that. I think it was something that was in the rule the entire time, but ACA had been paying that share of it. But once reviewed the actual documents and the agreement, DJJ should not have been receiving payment for those. So it's kind of like an audit review, and it was exposed that was not a funding that could be paid by the feds for those services. But we will continue providing those services. They will now be paid through GR. So those children will still receive overlay services.
Representative Schwartz for follow-up.
Thank you. And just a quick follow-up is that, well, maybe the answer I hope will be quick. The behavioral health medical type services aren't being switched. Is that right? This the federal government is still picking up a portion of that, or is that included in the cut?
Loretta. You recognize.
It is the overlay services, the overlay services piece of it that we're dealing with that Medicaid will no longer be responsible for.
Yeah, Representative Kerner, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe I should pick your brain about this later on after the meeting, but what is the forecast for, because I see that we have the Supreme Court and District Court of Appeal, I guess, maintenance funds in here. What is the long-range outlook for a replacement of certain DCA facilities?
Loretta, you recognized?
And the long-range financial outlook did not address those. We only looked at, as I said, based on historical funding for the courts. And actually, in the case of the Supreme Court, at the time of the long-range plan, the critical statement of their buildings requiring maintenance and repairs was not available. So this was based on a four-year average of what previously had been funded for them. As we go forward into the next session, we can surely look at their requests, some of the needs of maintenance and repairs, and could opt to fund those at a higher level. So we're not wedged to these funding at this level. You could possibly increase those as we move along in the session.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
All right.
Okay, as Loretta just mentioned from the long-range financial outlook presentation, the prison population is estimated to increase by over 4,000 in the next 5 years. Today we have Kathy McCherron from the Office of Economic and Demographic Research to give us a presentation on the estimating conference and to talk about the how and why, the projecting estimates in the prison population. Ms. McCherron, you are recognized.
Of course it wasn't because you were there. Is that better? Okay. Sorry about that. Staff, the Criminal Justice Estimating Conference. To give you a little background, the Estimating Conference typically meets three times a year to develop official information relating to the criminal justice system, and that's including forecasts of prison admissions and population for state planning and budgeting system. One thing to note about that, we'll be meeting again in November. We met in July. We'll meet again in February before session. So that when we do see things, we have close monitoring, and things often will shift by small amounts whenever we meet. The projections are usually based on current law and current administration. The principals include staff from the House and the Senate, the Governor's Office of Planning and Budgeting, and the Legislature's Office of Economic and Demographic Research. In addition to those three conferences where we look at the prison population and admissions, we meet as a criminal justice impact conference to determine the prison bed impact of proposed legislation. So if we have proposed legislation that creates new felony offenses or increases the penalty for existing offenses, that will often affect the number of prison beds that are needed. And alternatively, those that create diversion programs or reduce the penalties for existing may impact the number of prison beds that are needed. And I say may because in some cases the offense is a low-volume offense that doesn't really have a large impact on the number of beds. We met on February 19th of last year, or this year, and again on, seems so long ago, and again on July 23rd. In February, CEJIC had projected that the 12-13 prison admissions would increase by just 0.2% from 11-12, so thinking that they would remain pretty flat. However, when the count came in, the actual 12-13 admissions were 3.1% higher than in 11-12, and I'll go on to talk about those. So it did appear that we needed to adjust upward. July's CEJIC projected prison admissions compared to the February 13 to be, we're expecting them to be about 1,500 higher for 13-14. Of course, a lot of that we had already received. Close to 2,000 for 14-15, and again close to 2,000 additional for 15-16, so not much change in those two from one to the other. The fiscal 13-14 admissions are now projected to be 34,420, and that's 2.7% above fiscal 12-13. So note that conference agreed to an increase that's slightly lower than what we had observed in the prior in the current year over the prior year. The projected prison population is expected to be about 2,000 higher at the end of on June 30th of 14, close to 3,000 higher on June 30th 15, and about 3,500 in 16. And the June 30th 14 prison population is now expected to be about 102,225. To give you a little perspective on that growth, this shows the prison population on June 30th, actual and projected, from the February conference and the July conference and the actual. So you see that we did increase, the conference did increase the projection of the prison pop, but we're not looking at the kinds of growth that we had seen back in the early 2000s. I'll go over some of the places that we looked at and the indicators and help you get to where the conference got to on that increase. We've observed four-year declines in these indicators, in crime trends, I'll go into this a little further, judicial system trends, and in year-and-a-day sentences, where we've actually seen 6 years of declines. So if you look at index crimes, we have had those 4 years of pretty strong declines. Not so much in 2011, but in 2012 and the 2 years prior to 11, declines of greater than 5%. We hadn't seen anything that high since 2001. The crime rate also continues to decline, and in 2012 it declined 6.5%. We've seen declines in trends in filings and guilty dispositions. Again, you know, some slowing in the guilty dispositions. We saw a 2% decline, and the declines in the prior 3 years had been higher. Didn't see that in the felony filings. And we continue to see some decline in, when we looked at the first few months we looked at January through May of 2013. So in guilty dispositions, we did see still a 4.5 decline over the prior year. Year-and-a-day new commitments to prison, and those of you who have been on the committee for a few years remember that we had seen huge increases in that, where back in 2007-08, we had over 40,000 new commitments, at the prior year, we had 6,600 year-and-a-day commitments in that year. That's down to just a little over 2,000, actually below what it was at the beginning of the 2000s. So that seems to be pretty much under control, and that's a good thing for prison population. But we have seen some recent increases in arrests and in the new commitments to prison and technical violators. In arrests, very, very slight, but we did see a 0.8% increase in 2012 over 2011. And you see we had several years of pretty strong declines prior to that. In new commitments, again, we had 5 years of strong declines. Let me start back even at 2006-07. We had 3 years of increases beginning in 2005-06 of 7% or more. And then we dropped to a minus 5% and had negative growth in excess of 5% for 4 years in a row. And then last year it jumped up to 3.1%. We had technical violators to prison, which, again, if you all were here early in the decade, you remember the issues of some changes at DOC that meant that a lot more technical violators were from probation and community control were coming to prison. That peaked in 2006-07 with 11,000. We're now down again below early in the decade. But we did see a slight increase in the last fiscal year over the prior, and that was a little bit of a concern. So we've had inconsistent indicators that are looked at. We had the four-year declines in the crime rate, felony filings, felony guilty dispositions, and year-and-a-day sentences, and increases in recent increases in arrests, new commitments, and technical violators. One of the things that happens with in looking at when data changes, when we go from a negative to a positive or positive to a negative, is always trying to evaluate whether that's an aberration that will even itself back out or whether it is a true change in trends. What we do find is when we have a population increase, sometimes we know exactly what was happening. When there's been major legislation like 1020 Life or anti-murder, we've built in, we know that we're going to be seeing some increases. What also happens, though, and what drives a lot of the criminal justice indicators and why it takes us a while to determine what is actually happening and what the long term will be, is human behavior. And that may be everything from how police and sheriffs are staffing, whether they have resources to have more people on the street, whether there have been local initiatives, whether there have been changes in internal policy at the Department of Corrections or in the supervision program that may result in more people coming. So what we will do is we're always in touch with the Office of the State Courts Administrator. They're very helpful in requesting information at the local level, and we'll be getting a six-month report from UCR, hopefully in October, from FDLE. So we'll have a six-month of information to look at. And we will continue to monitor so that we're on target as close as we can be. Where we have been in just 2 months, we were 188 lower than what we had expected in admissions, and our population was less than 100 different. So that's where the conference is right now. And again, we'll be meeting in mid-November probably to reassess and determine whether those need to be shifted up or down. That concludes. Question?
Any questions from the members? Any questions? Ranking Member Roussan, you are recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Do you have any statistics on returning inmates, on the numbers coming out? You have numbers going in.
You were recognized, Ms. Sharon?
I'm sorry, sir. In terms of recidivism, do you mean? Or
no. Well, leaving prison, going back into the community each year.
Yes. Actually, we do because...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, I'm sorry. Well, if I can get it out of my bag, I have those numbers. Had them here all along. Mm-hmm. Because the way that we do the modeling, the admissions are forecast, and you basically have a balancing so that you have the population at the end of the last known period and then the projected admissions and the projected releases. So we actually do project releases based on the number of based on two subsets of the population, the folks who are currently in prison, that DOC can give us information on when they expect to be released, and then we apply a matrix of how long folks who are coming in stay. So there's a declining function, basically, that tells us that after 6 months, some percent of a admissions cohort will have left. After 12 months, a certain, and we have that for all the months of the forecast, so that we're looking at in terms of losses in 12-13 of about 33. Well, the actual last year was 33,146, and for 13-14, 33,079, 14-15, 33,492. and they stay in that 33%, 34% range throughout. One of the things that will affect that, of course, are sentence lengths, and we have seen an increase in sentence lengths in the last 5 years of about a half, 7 months, so that 85% of that means folks are staying an additional 6 months, and that will affect the population also.
Any other questions or members? Representative Schwartz, you're recognized.
Yeah, thank you so much. And thanks. When you said your name, you didn't have the mic on. What is your name?
Kathy McCarron.
Kathy McCarron. Great. There's one statistic that puzzled me, mm-hmm. and probably you've explained it by explaining some of the drivers, but there's this kind of outlier number here on page 12. In 2009, the guilty dispositions percentage change 13.5%. I wonder if there was ever something that you have handy that what happened? And
Ms. McCarron, you're recognized.
I'm sorry. I'm very sorry that I don't. That's FDLE. I'm sorry. OSCA
right.
data. And I can certainly, and I will ask them if they have ever been able to evaluate what happened in that year.
Yeah, but it's only, as you went on, I'm sorry.
Representative Schwartz, you're recognized for a follow-up.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. It just may be one of those things. I just think it's also fascinating that you said that the length of the term of the incarceration got longer, which would be a main driver to having a larger prison population, it seems. Do you know why there was a change in the length of the term?
Ms. McCarron, you recognize?
Thank you. One thing that has happened is because we had those year-and-a-day sentences at such a high level, that brought the average sentence length down. And as you decrease the number of those with a year and a day in the population, in the admissions, you're going to have an increase without any other increases showing. We don't see large differences in by offense category or anything in sentence length. So it's primarily the change in the folks who are going that it appears that more folks with more serious offenses are going to prison than there had been a few years ago.
Any other questions for members? Okay, Ms. McCarron, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Members, the 2013-2014 appropriation from the Department of Corrections funds the department for the outsourcing of comprehensive health services programs. Mr. Tim Cannon, Deputy Secretary, is here to provide the committee with an update. Mr. Cannon, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee. Good morning. Thanks for the opportunity to be here today to talk about our health services privatization. I am Tim Cannon. I'm the Deputy Secretary with the Department. Next slide, please. First of all, our health services privatization was a result of the 2011 legislative session. The comprehensive health care contracts include medical, mental health, and dental services. The Department retained our pharmacy services. They're not currently included in the contract, but could be added at a later date. As a result of these contracts, the required cost savings versus DC operations, we have 191 performance measures in place for monitoring purposes. So as we move forward, we'll be moving forward with monitoring services to include those 191 performance measures for the vendors. Next slide, please. The first contract was with Wexford Healthcare Services. It was executed on December the 18th, 2012. This contract was for about $48 million. Again, executed December 18th, 2012. There were no legal challenges to this particular contract. The transition of the 9 institutions in the South Florida area, the extreme south, was completed on March 24th, 2013. Wexford extended offers to 91% of the former D.C. employees, plus an additional 183 contracted employees who were working in mental health, which was already outsourced at the time of the contract. Contract monitoring for that contract begins October 1st, 2013. Next slide. Then the contract with Corizon, the most recent contract, was executed on October the 15th, 2012. It included 40 institutions. This contract is worth about approximately $230 million per year. Again, executed October the 15th, 2012. There were was a nine-month delay due to legal challenges in reference to this contract. The transition of the 40 institutions is currently in progress. 27 institutions have been completed. That transition is complete. The 13 remaining institutions will be complete by October 13th. We set that up where the most complex medical institutions were at the back end. That's the one that will be completed by October the 13th, including our reception and medical center at Lake Butler, which includes an in-house hospital. So there were a lot of complexities there, and that one will be completed October the 13th. Contract monitoring for this contract will begin April 1st, 2014. We have no information currently on the percent hired because that contract is not complete, but as soon as that information is available, we'll be glad to provide that as well. And we will have that after the October 13th date. And with me today, I have Mr. Tom Reimers, our Director of Health Service Administration. So if there is some questions that he can help with, I'll certainly ask him to come up. But at this time, I would like to open up the questions.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Cannon. Are there any questions from the members? Representative Kerr, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Deputy Secretary. Of the 91% of DOC employees that were offered positions, what percent accepted?
Mr. Cannon, you're recognized.
Yes, sir. 82% of those 91% accepted. That entailed 260 employees.
I have a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Are there any on the contract with Corizon? I understand that only 27 institutions are complete, 13 are not. Do you have any breakdowns of similar breakdowns? I know you don't have for the overall contract, but do you have any sub-breakdowns for those offered positions and those that accepted?
Okay. Sure.
Mr. Cannon, you're recognized.
Not at this time. We don't have the specific breakdowns. However, we've had several meetings via conference call and some face-to-face meetings with Corizon, and it appears that these numbers percentage-wise will be very similar to what we had with Westford.
Any other questions for members?
Sure.
Representative Schwartz, you're recognized.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you so much. And it's a quite an undertaking to have this transition, though it's been in the making a long time. I have a series of questions. One is, are either Wexford or Corizon publicly traded companies, or are they owned by publicly traded companies?
Mr. Cannon, you're recognized.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware. Mr. Reimers, are you aware of that? I'm not sure of the answer to that.
Follow-up?
In other words, there's no SEC requirement that the compensation to the executive suite be revealed, or is there any way in the contracting of these that there was any understanding of what the executive compensation was for the leaders of these companies?
Mr. Cannon, you're recognized.
Again, I'm not sure. I'm afraid we would have to talk directly to the contractor for those answers.
Thank you.
Ranking Member Roussan, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And Deputy Secretary, thank you for what you're doing and have done for Department of Corrections. My understanding is that both of these companies are out-of-state headquartered companies. Is that correct?
Mr. Cannon?
You want to join me, Mr. Cannon? That is correct, yes.
Okay. Follow up.
Follow up.
Do we know how many Florida-based companies are participating in each of these contracts?
Mr. Cannon, you're recognized.
I'm afraid I need a little more clarification. As far as providing services under the contract?
Yes, sir.
I'm not sure that answer off the top of my head, but I do know there are some subcontractors that provide different services like those mental health we talked about. And we can certainly find out and provide that information to you.
All right.
Follow up?
And we talked about this at one point when these contracts were initially being discussed. And do we know how many minority-owned companies are subcontractors or providing services to Wexford or Corizon?
Mr. Cannon, you recognize?
I do not know off the top of my head, but I can certainly get that information as well.
Okay. Clarification.
Another follow-up?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for clarification purposes, what I'm asking about would be not only women-owned companies or Hispanic and also African-American companies that might be Florida companies that are providing services or participating in contracts.
Mr. Cannon.
Again, I can certainly get that information, and if we have the opportunity, we can certainly talk to the vendors and get that information to them as well.
Thank you.
Any other questions for members? Representative Slossberg, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this this contract's worth $230 million?
Mr. Cannon, you're recognized.
Thank you, sir. Yes, sir.
Per year?
Yes, sir.
And
follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Get you back in the groove.
I forgot. I thought I was in Boca.
No.
And so just to follow up on Representative Roussan, what he was asking, were any Florida companies involved in the bidding on this? This seems like a pretty big contract.
Mr. Cannon, you recognize?
I'm not sure who all bid on it, but it was open to everyone.
Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that a criteria to look at Florida-based companies since we are trying to improve our job outlook, especially if they're competitive or it just doesn't matter and we just close our eyes and we say, $250 million is $250 million. Is that how? I'm just curious.
Mr. Cannon, you're recognized.
To my knowledge, it is just awarded to the lowest bidder who can provide the quality of care.
For a follow-up, Representative Salisbury.
So, in other words, we don't really care if it's a Florida-based company.
Mr. Cannon, you're recognized to respond.
Yes, Tom Reimers, Director of Health Services Administration.
Mr. Reimer, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Many of the subcontractors that both companies, Corizon and Wexford, have hired were our subcontractors. And so you're going to see, we'll get you the information, Mr. Chair, on the numbers. But you'll see that a large amount of the subcontractors are Florida-based companies.
Follow-up, Representative Salisbury.
Thank you. But on the other hand, they could have just done that to do that. And then once they have the contract, they could do whatever they want to do. Correct?
Mr. Reimer, I guess if you want to respond to that, you can.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank
they
you.
Have to put together an adequate network to provide care.
Any other questions from members? Representative Pilon, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Deputy Secretary, you kind of your voice kind of trailed away there when you answered one of those questions. I want to make sure that you answered the question. You accept the lowest bid, but you also added one more sentence to that. Would you repeat that? In other words, what I'm getting at, they are the lowest best bid. Is that correct?
Mr. Cannon, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The lowest bid that can provide the quality of care and the services as the contract dictated.
Thank you.
Okay, I don't see anybody else. So, Representative Schwartz, you're recognized.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I just wondered, is there a follow-up oversight evaluation of these companies? Is there a part of your department that follows through in some way to be sure? The populations, the prison populations, and these type of recipients of state services are not in a position to complain so much. I wondered if what kind of a setup is there to oversight of the work these companies are doing.
You're recognized, Mr. Cannon.
Yes, ma'am. That's a very good question. We do have contract monitors in place. We have a grievance system in place for our inmates to address any concerns that we follow up on through our central office and institutional staff, as well as those contract monitors. Very good question.
Any other questions for members?
A follow-up,
Representative Short.
I'm sorry. The contract monitors, are they state employees?
Mr. Cannon.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Seeing no further questions for members, thank you, gentlemen, both of you. And with that, Vice Chair Cummings moves we rise.